Alexandra,
hello.
Hi, Roger. Hello. Nice to see you. Nice to see you. I've been offline, so I don't know if you've tweeted back.
Well, you know, after being accused of not wanting foreign languages on trains, I thought I'd keep a dignified silence.
Sometimes silence.
I think most of the time.
If everybody wants to come and sit down, we're going to start our session any minute now. Could I ask everyone to come and sit down so we can get started? Thanks.
Right, so it's all the reform,
So, good afternoon, everyone. I'm delighted to welcome you to our second session this afternoon, EU Reform, What's in it for me? My name is Catherine Fuchs. I'm the Labour Assembly Member Candidate for Monmouth, and I'm delighted to be here to introduce our four panellists for you and try and keep them in some kind of order. So, there are three questions we really wanted to ask today. Is the EU fit for purpose and how should it change? How can the EU be reformed in a way that will bring greater benefit to British families? And finally, has David Cameron achieved his own goals on renegotiation or an own goal? And I guess that's all about the handbrake and whether it's going to work and whether it's achieved anything. So I'm delighted to welcome our first speaker, Wayne David MP. He's the Labour MP for Caerphilly, and he's been that since 2001. And he's also the Shadow Minister for Political Reform and Criminal Justice. So first of all, Wayne David.
Thanks so much.
Would you like that? Would you like this one?
Okay. First of all, my apologies, but I got the dreaded loogie. And I will struggle to speak for 4 minutes without my voice going completely. And could I say right at the start, I don't consider that to be part of a Eurosceptic plot. It's conservative germs, I'm afraid. My reason for being a strong advocate of the European Union is not because I slavishly defend the status quo, but because I think Europe can change for the better, and it certainly should change for the better. And I just want to underline some of the reasons in which Europe can and should change. One of the big successes of the European Union is the single European market. That is the bread and butter, if you like, of the European project, and it's of inestimable value to the United Kingdom. We are an exporting country, and having access to that large market right on the doorstep is tremendously important. But I think that a market is not enough. There needs to be a strong social dimension to that market. A strong social dimension in terms of the defence and enhancement of workers' rights, which there was some time ago, but as in the United Kingdom, so in the rest of Europe, political spectrum has changed and there's a greater influence of the right. I think it's important that that is redressed and there's more support given to the idea of workers' rights, paternity rights, health and safety rights, but also the establishment and extension of what we call in this country minimum wage, national living wage. So I think that aspect of the social dimension is important. It's also important to put a bigger emphasis, I would argue, on regional policy. Because the market by itself, like it doesn't create equality between individuals, it doesn't create equality between nations and regions. There needs to be positive intervention in the market. And strong regional policy is absolutely vital to that. We in Wales have benefited from regional policy in the past and today, Objective 1 and so on, and that needs to be given a much bigger profile. So that's the first one, in terms of economy. The second thing I would think is very important is that we place a fresh emphasis on tackling such issues as environmental change and pollution. Global warming. It's a truism, isn't it? That pollution doesn't recognise any boundaries. It doesn't. And if we are serious about tackling climate change and ensuring that our climate protects this and future generations. It's very, very important, I would argue, we work with other European countries to ensure that European standards are maintained and enhanced. It's also important in that context that we recognise that we live in an increasingly globalised economy. And one of the features of that is the free movement of people, not just in Europe, but increasingly throughout the world. And that means that as well as ordinary people able to move freely, we also see criminals moving freely as well. One of the big successes of the European Union to date has been the European Arrest Warrant. We need to make sure that that is maintained and enhanced and strengthened, and in many ways it's improved upon, but certainly not scrapped, as Eurosceptics would want to see happen, by withdrawing us from the European Union. It's also important that we have increased police cooperation with Europol and between different police forces in different member states. And the third and final thing I'd say is that we need to have more democracy inside the European Union. The European Union is essentially an association of independent sovereign member states who pool their sovereignty from time to time on different issues. I believe in the principle of subsidiarity. Decisions should be taken at the most appropriate level, close to the people. But there should be more democracy at all levels. At a European level, I would like to see more powers given to the European Parliament in certain specific areas. But I also think, too, that the Council of Ministers, who are the representatives of the member states, should operate in a more collective and democratic way. There should be more transparency, there should be more openness, and that they should relate more to their national parliaments and what they do. But the very last point I'd make is this. I think that Europe, at the end of the day, is about human beings coming together and learning from each other and working together. My good friend a few years ago, John Hume, was a member of the European Parliament, as I was. And he always used to say, no matter the faults and imperfections of the European Union, remember, it is always better to have jaw, not war. And I think that's very, very important. In essence, this decision we'll have to make, probably in the next few months, is between internationalism or nationalism. And I'm proud to call myself an internationalist.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Wayne. That's really interesting that you brought in the emotion there that we talked about in the previous session. I'm really delighted to introduce our next speaker, who I think is probably a bit like me. I speak Catalan. I don't speak Welsh. I apologise for that. I am learning. But I do speak Catalan, and Roger speaks about six different languages, including Italian, German and French. And he's director of the New European. So our next speaker, please welcome Roger Casale. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much for that very kind invitation. I'll switch the stop clock on. I'm actually British because I was debating with Stephen Wolfe from UKIP the other day, and he thought I was Italian, so I've got an Italian name, but I am actually British. But I want to speak for many people who actually like my forebears, my great-grandfather, who came to Britain as an immigrant. And now we have over 3 million EU migrants, or as I like to call them, mobile EU citizens, who are in Britain. And I know that Nigel Farage said they've been clogging up the M4, so I decided to get the train today to Cardiff, and then I remembered that he'd also said that he was disturbed on the train by people speaking foreign languages, so I made sure I sat in the quiet zone. Actually, all of a sudden in Newport, a lot of people got on the train speaking a foreign language, which I couldn't understand, which turned out to be Welsh, and they were on the way to the Swansea game. But we do have 3 million people in the UK at least who are building their lives and their futures here and who feel very anxious about what would happen to them if Britain were to leave the European Union. And New Europeans is a platform for them to have a voice and to be heard and to be seen for the contribution that they make. But let me say in response to the questions, because I've only got another 2.5 minutes to go, that they, of course, will not be able to vote in this referendum, but they will be affected by the outcome of the referendum, as will the 2 million British, over 2 million British people who live outside the outside Britain in the EU, but as will all of us, actually, in Britain ourselves. And I think that what's important to understand, I think, about this referendum is that not only is this not going to be decided by the Brits abroad or the 3 million EU citizens who are here, even though their interests will be directly affected, it's not going to be really decided by the people in this room. It's not going to be decided by Alexandra, it's not going to be decided by me or Wayne or others. It's going to be decided by millions and millions of people who probably haven't started thinking about this yet, who probably don't know which way they're going to go. And we really have should have done much more work, but we haven't, over the last decades, to really raise awareness about what our relationship with Europe is and why it matters. And I think that it's too short a time now before the referendum to be able to do that. And therefore, it's going to be difficult to get what is really quite a complex argument across in a short period of time to millions of people who haven't really started thinking about it yet. I think what's important is that people do understand what this means to them. And I was at an event recently where somebody said to me, "Oh, you new Europeans, Europe, tell me about Europe, talk to me about Europe." And I said, "No, really, you don't want me to do that. You don't want me to, you know, I can get on my soapbox and talk about Europe for half an hour. Why don't you tell me about what you're doing?" And what he said was, "Well, I work for a small company outside London that does interior design for yachts." I said, "Oh, that's interesting." And I said, "So does anybody work in your office from another EU member state?" And he said, "Yeah, we've got a Greek and an Italian." I said, "I see. And what are you doing next week?" He said, "Next week I'm going to be in Trieste in Italy because we've got a contract from a French contractor." So I said, "Look, you're talking to me about Europe. You asked me, but you're actually Tim." He said, "Yeah, but I thought there was much more to it than that." I said, "No, this is it. This is it. This is so much into your in life and into your company and into what you are doing that you probably don't realise it. But ladies and gentlemen, this is what is at stake if we come out of the European Union. And we have to find a way to have a very simple message to get people to wake up and understand what it means to them and what they stand to lose if Britain were to leave the EU." Now, I'm aware that I haven't addressed the questions in my 4 minutes, but I wanted to make that opening statement, and I will come back to those in the questions if I may. So thank you very much. I think that's 4 minutes.
Thank you, Roger. I'd now like to introduce Alexandra Phillips, who's head of media at UKIP, and she's been that since 2013. And before that, she worked at the BBC and ITV and used to study in Cardiff at the university here.
Hello, thank you. Surprising, I don't have horns and red eyes, and the only foreign language that I don't want on trains in the UK is ECJ legalese. Anyway, I realise I'm a bit on my own on this panel, possibly even in this room. Well, that's okay, because the latest YouGov polling has me as part of the majority when it comes to this debate. But what is it that we're really debating? One word: democracy. The reformists will tell you that the EU can change, that it should change. But where is the evidence to support that? David Cameron, in his Bloomberg speech 3 years ago, said that he was going to claw back significant powers. He wanted to shape the EU from within. What do we actually have? Have you seen Tusk's letter? What do we actually have? A watered-down set of proposals that simply request permission to, at some stage in the future, request further permission from 27 other countries and unelected bureaucrats in Brussels to tinker around the edges of our own welfare system. Watching the Prime Minister of our country, the fifth largest economy in the world, go with his begging bowl around Europe to ask to give voters in Britain what they want, that is shameful. And I'm sorry, to me, that is not democracy. This is not a fight about in-work benefits. It's not even protection from further integration, because quite frankly, with the Lisbon Treaty, that horse has already bolted. It's the vast chunk of legislation that affects your lives, all of you in here, that is no longer made in Westminster, but by unelected commissioners who actually are at the behest of multinational lobbyists, not serving British interests. It's the inability of the UK to determine who does come into this country, to independently decide the role we, as a country, want to play in geopolitics. It's the inability to have any sort of real democratic control over our future. I don't want to leave this country to my children, caught up in an unaccountable, supranational organisation that operates exploitative economic partnership agreements with the developing world, that pushes ahead with secret trade deals that would block generic medicines being sold to European charities upon which 15 million lives in West Africa depend. I don't want to say to my children, well, do you know what, once upon a time we were free, we got to vote on this. I want to ensure they inherit a country with a high standard of living that upholds the values generations have fought for, that is prosperous and is safe, and which they can be part of the democratic governance. So often, the in-out debate seems to be framed through virtue signalling, as if the call for sovereignty is somehow distasteful, dangerous nationalism. For me, it is actually a moral argument. It is about what's right. For me, it is about democracy. We've given up our right to have our own seat on the World Trade Organization. In fact, Brussels are planning on trying to usurp our seat on the UN Security Council. We will be made, and we are made, as part of a political bloc to do things that we don't want to do, regardless of the consequences. But who are these people who insist they must continue speaking on our behalf? One thing is clear, worse than not listening to the UK as a major stakeholder in the EU, as one of the biggest contributors to their slush fund, worse than not listening to our point of view, they do listen and abjectly ignore it. That's not democracy. This is an organisation that removed democratically elected leaders from member states when their single currency policy project failed, replaced them with apparatchiks from the so-called Troika, from the IMF, the ECB, people whose interests lie with Goldman Sachs, not thousands of people forced into unemployment. So think long and hard before you decide which side of the fence you sit. Europe's ambition agenda pushes frontiers of the EU, of this country, into the Middle East and into Russia. We'll be dragged into geopolitical manoeuvres in which we have no say, topped off with the open borders that we can't control, economic insecurity from being partially shackled to a failing single currency. And we are going to be increasingly denied a voice, just as Cameron's failed negotiations currently going on in Europe are proving. The EU didn't bulldoze its megalomania across the continent using military hardware. No, no one's claiming that. Its weapons are bureaucracy, incomprehensible legalese, propaganda, and unpickable treaties. But the results are the same. We no longer govern ourselves. Without sovereignty, not a single person in the UK, in this room, anywhere, can honestly say that they can promise security and prosperity for the future, because the power to make those important decisions is being mortgaged away, and they will soon be entirely out of our hands.
Thank you, Alex. So I think, Alex, we can safely say that she doesn't think David Cameron has achieved anything with this renegotiation. I think that certainly answered the last question from Alex's point of view. Now it gives me great pleasure to introduce Jeremy Miles, who's the Welsh Labour and Cooperative Assembly member, sorry, candidate, I should say, for Nice. Thank you.
Hopefully member.
Thank you very much. Well, I was going to start in another European language, Welsh, but since the headphones have been taken away, I'll pass it to you. There are two issues, I think, which the European reform agenda need to grapple with. The first is a perception amongst some that the EU is remote and unaccountable, and therefore in some way, as a result, illegitimate. And the second is a perception that the EU doesn't do anything for me, effectively. And in order to grapple with those two issues, I think we need to see it in a broader context, which is to say that our politics in the UK, apparently at the moment, we're living through a phase where the politics of identity have come to the fore and to some extent replaced the politics of delivery. So you see on the left with the SNP, an embrace of Scottishness is obscuring really what is quite a patchy delivery on the ground. And you see on the right, if I may, with UKIP, where an embrace of a particular kind of Britishness is obscuring a policy agenda that many would find problematic. And in the context of that question of identity, Europeanism in the UK, in my opinion, isn't a winning identity. And as we avoid, as we have to avoid, a dodgy nationalism based on a fictitious view of the past, we also have to avoid a dodgy Europeanism based on a fictitious view of the future, in a sense. So moving beyond that, I'm pleased to see that the emphasis on today's discussions are on the practical impact of the EU, the pragmatic, practical, delivery-focused aspects of the EU. And with that in mind, how do we address those two major challenges? Firstly, the question of remoteness and lack of accountability. It seems to me there is great scope for improving the democratic oversight of the European Union. One of the, in a sense, more straightforward ways of doing that is enhancing the role of Parliament and in Wales the Assembly in the scrutiny and oversight of European legislation. I think there's some way we could go to improve that. The other solution, which is being discussed at the moment, of course, is this question of the yellow card, where national parliaments work together effectively to police subsidiarity. And there's work that can be done on that, which doesn't require treaty change if the Commission were happy to regard that as a red card, effectively. So there are practical things from a democratic point of view, which I think can be done and should be done to address that concern. It seems to me as well there's work that can be done to streamline the institutions of the European Union themselves. Things like the movement to Strasbourg of the Parliament, I think that doesn't reflect well, in my opinion, on the European Union. There may be ways of streamlining the Commission and so on. So there are practical things to do. But I just want to echo Wayne's point. In looking at how we address the question of what the European Union does for us, so to speak, we need to look beyond the Union as being simply an economic union. And we have to remember as well that it's a social union. And that requires, I think, some imagination to see how we can take forward that agenda. We've had the social Europe in the form of workplace rights and so on. We've had the social union in terms of structural funds. We see this week the Welsh Government calling for the UK Government to ask for globalisation adjustment funds from Europe. So there are all sorts of tools within the EU which already address these issues. There may be a question about how we use European funding to deal with the differential impact of migration in different parts of the EU. These are all questions we should look at. But in terms of the practical daily impact of the EU, I think one of the major issues is a knowledge gap, a lack of understanding of what the European Union does. If you were to ask most people here in Wales what the EU does for them, they probably wouldn't recognise the extent of employment rights that they have from the EU. They wouldn't recognise the impact of EU funds on broadband, energy efficiency, Jobs Growth Wales, skills training, town centre regeneration, all those things which are very practical daily benefits, as well as what we talked about already in earlier sessions about the benefits of travel and so on. So I think one of the major issues is to increase the understanding of what the European Union does and the benefits which have accrued to us as a result of those.
Thank you. Thanks very much, everyone. We've now got time for some questions from the floor. I think our four speakers have summed up clearly. They all feel, actually, that there's a lack of information and a lack of good communication. And then, obviously, you all heard Alex's point, which is her feeling is that there's a complete lack of democracy in the European Union. But I'd ask you to think back about those questions that we had posed to us at the beginning about is the EU fit for purpose and what's in it for me. So who would like to ask a question? Okay, I'll take the three gentlemen, one at the back and one there.
I'm Neil Evans from the Rhondda.
Sorry, can you say your name again?
I'm Neil Evans from the Rhondda Valley. My question is primarily about Alex.
I guessed it might be.
I currently live in an objective-1 funded area.
Yep.
So obviously the EU has pumped millions of pounds into my area to rejuvenate. Obviously, I'm assuming if Westminster has those millions of pounds, they would have come to the home we did. So if, as you say, you recommend we come out of Europe, where do you envisage further funding to rejuvenate the valleys coming from?
Okay, now Stuart at the back there, please. I'm taking three at a time. I'll deal the questions out.
Yes, just a question for Alexandra. I do respect the fact that taking the sequence to the paper, because it can't be the easiest place to come in the position. You talked about the renegotiation and what the Prime Minister's got, and said we lack the influence that we should have in the European Union. The things that he came back with, so the Business of Britain said they wanted a red card to force the EU to abandon policy, we got that. Matthew Elliott, the one vote leader, I don't know which side of this thing you're on, one vote leader, said he wanted an end to ever closer union, we got that. Paul Nuttall from UKIP said he wanted to protect our taxpayers from this benefit called Bonanza. The Prime Minister got the 4-year limit on people on migrant spending and criminal welfare. And Matthew Elliott again said he wanted to cut EU, again, quote, red tape for SMEs, and perhaps we've got that. We wouldn't have been able to achieve these changes if he wasn't on the table. I wonder now how you're going to persist in making this case that Britain doesn't influence the European Union when we palpably have.
And the third question, the gentleman in the grey suit here.
Reminds me a little bit about the sketch from Monty Python, what have the Romans ever done for us? What has the European Union ever done for us? Well, I remember having a conversation with an MEP about how structural funds are spent in Wales. And he said, oh, we put up big signs in Austin, this is being done. And then a little small print logo funded by the European Union. And then I said, why don't you politicians and the media, you know, give credit where credit is due? And he said it's Brussels' fault that they don't highlight that they are funding this. So damned if you do, damned if you don't. My question is, again, more back to this, how do you communicate to people what the European Union has done for the UK?
Thank you. So can I take that question first to you, Wayne? Yeah.
Thank you.
How do you communicate best?
Right. It's a very good question and not an easy one to answer. Because, you know, I'll be frank with you. I think that the support and sympathy for the European Union has probably diminished in Wales over the last 20 years or so. And I think it's partly the fault of national governments, it's partly the fault of the European Union itself. One of the attitudes which has been shown by, again to be frank, the Labour governments as well as Conservative administration, is that Europe is something which is done to us, and national enhancement is achieved by fighting and defeating the Europeans on this, that and the other. I think that's been a profound mistake. Where the emphasis should always be on working with Europeans to achieve things collectively. But I think there's been political capital gained for that, and that's one of the reasons why public mood is as it is. I think the other point I make is with regard to the European Union itself. Certainly until quite recently, I think, there's been an attitude amongst many in European Union institutions, Commission, Parliament and to the Council to some extent, but Europe was all about ever closer union, right? And that somehow it is not so much the belief in the principle of subsidiarity, but the creation of an ever closer union so that more and more powers would be lost by the nation states to the centre. And I think there was always that tension between those who had that vision of an integrated Europe and those of us who believed in a far looser association. And I think what has happened over the last few years, because of the strength of public opinion, increasingly those of us who believe in Europe are winning the argument, and Europe is seen as more of a looser association. And bigger emphasis is being placed on devolving power down, in our case, to the Welsh Assembly, but also an enhancement of the position of a nation state. So I think there's a redefinition of Europe taking place, which I think is something to be welcomed, in my view. It's more in touch with people's realities. It's at the same time, it's in touch with the modern world as it's developing. Could I also add just one final point? I think it's Stuart who mentioned about the negotiation that David Cameron is involved in. As a Labour Member of Parliament, I'll be slightly controversial. And I'll say that Cameron has done a pretty good job. He's done a pretty good job in a very limited way. A number of the things which he appears to have achieved are to be welcomed, and I certainly welcome those. But I would make a point also that what I want is a different kind of Europe. And the kind of Europe I want to see, which I touched upon in my opening statement, cannot be achieved through short negotiations. It can only be achieved through a process of engagement, long-term and construction of relationships and alliances with others in the European Union. And that's the real challenge for progressives in the European Union, to establish international links so that we change Europe for better in the long term.
Okay, and now I'd like to ask Alex about to answer the question. Neil Evans from the Rhondda said, where would funding come from for areas in the valleys that need funding? I think you can actually speak into that microphone,
okay.
Guys. Can
people still hear? Good question, Neil, and one that actually I've been looking forward to answering, because let's actually break down the mathematics of this. The Welsh Assembly receives per annum £491 million from Europe, okay? Welsh statistics. Now, if you imagine that 5% of the UK contribution comes from Wales, and we pay annually £20 billion per annum, that puts the Welsh bill at £1 million. So actually getting £500 million, half of it back, and being told how to spend it, doesn't seem like a very good deal to me.
No,
now, actually, when we first had the expansion from the EU15 to the EU27, from 2014 onwards, who are then going to be receiving structural funding, and everyone in Wales put their hands up in horror and said, well, we're not going to be able to make the 75% limit anymore. We'll miss out on this funding. Do you know what the biggest tragedy is, Neil? We didn't. We didn't miss out on the funding. We still qualify for it because it's not done anything, because it's not working in the interests of Welsh people, because by and large, actually, it is a propaganda exercise. And this whole idea that Europe is not communicating what it's doing that's beneficial. No, that is what Europe does on a regular basis.
Sorry, Alex, to interrupt, but can you answer the question?
Yeah, so
what funds would you make available to the Rhondda?
£55 million a day, which would be going back into national coffers. And the idea here that there are representatives from the Labour Party who say, well, if it's not for Europe, that money wouldn't come to Wales. What would a Labour government do? Redig Offa's dike? Cut off the funding? We would all be more prosperous. We'd have liberty to decide how things are best spent for our communities that aren't in hock with the European 2020 agenda, that aren't in hock with a far bigger supranational global ambition, but that are right for Wales. And if you look at the impact, on one hand, that European regulation has been having on the decimation of the steel industry and the thousands of jobs lost, 7 out of 8 of the major metal ore refineries shut since 2007, the decimation that's had on the Welsh economy. And then you wonder what this little bit of money we get back, that's yours in the first place to begin with, what it's doing, is it helping, why are we still qualifying for it? Simple, because we don't make the rules ourselves anymore. We don't determine what is the best fit.
Can I ask Jeremy to respond to the same point?
Yeah, the answer to your question is where the money's coming from is not coming. you know, this idea that there's a pot of largesse that would be released, which Conservative governments from Westminster are going to invest in the valleys is just a myth, not least because the money isn't going to be released. As we know from the Norwegian experience, they pay 80% per capita of what we pay to the European Union to be outside it, effectively, to be part of the market. So the money is not going to be released in the way that you
We wouldn't be following a Norwegian model. That's utterly irrelevant.
Well, we don't know what we'd be following on your analysis. But I think it's like, there isn't a person, I think, in this room who thinks that there's going to be an equivalent level of funding coming to Wales.
What, £55 million
per day overall? Either in the form of objective of funding for the valleys or cap funding.
I'd like to ask Roger Casale to respond to Stuart's point about how can you say, and then we'll come to Alex after Roger's had a chance to respond. How can you say Britain doesn't have influence in Europe, was Stuart's point. You can speak into that.
Right, well, I hope I can say something on the other questions as well.
Yes, you can. Yeah.
No, I have to say I agree with Alexandra on this. I think Britain's influence is actually at an all-time low. I mean, I know it's important for those making the case for Britain staying in to sort of say that we do have influence and this deal is important and so on, but I do think it's pretty small beer what's been achieved, and I think it's not surprising, because if you think about all the other challenges, climate change, migration crisis, the economic crisis, to be taking up everybody's time running around, you know, trying to get this through to satisfy the Eurosceptics in the Tory party, really has diminished Britain's influence, I think, to an all-time low. So I'm afraid that that's my view about it. And we're going to have to work on building it up again, because I think that Britain has a great contribution to make to Europe, and there's a lot that needs to change, particularly in the single market, completion of the digital market, and other areas and more competitiveness, where the British voice needs to be heard more clearly. But I would just like to say that it sounded to me as if Alexandra was making a kind of pitch for the Welsh Assembly rather than comment about the referendum, because just to remind any of you who are a mobile EU citizen that you will have the vote in the Welsh Assembly, and although there is a group I know called Polish Friends of Europe, it's pretty much a minority interest, and so I do hope very much that EU citizens here will take part in the referendum. They can't take part in the referendum. They can take part in the assembly elections. They've been excluded from the referendum. And just on this point of very quickly on this point of how to communicate, I think the problem is that the people who will really decide this referendum, the undecideds, the ones who know very little about Europe, and they're going to know very little, even less about the details of the renegotiation package. Let's be honest, even we people who follow this very closely but know very little about the details of the renegotiation package at the moment. So, you know, let's be careful about talking it up too much. I think the problem is, in terms of communicating, is that neither side of the referendum campaign have understood is that the people who will decide it, the undecideds at the moment, are probably fed up with being talked to. And what they actually want is to be listened to. And they want to have the chance to ask their questions without being talked down to, without being given information that's not correct, without being talked to in a kind of the polemical way that we've heard today from UKIP. And it is good that UKIP are here and that this voice is being heard, because they represent a lot of people and we have to engage with that. But in the end, it's not going to be, you know, who shouts loudest. It's going to be who listens most closely. And we need to find a way for people to discover their own stake in Europe. It's obvious for mobile EU citizens what that is. It's obvious for British citizens abroad. It's obvious for students, actually. It's obvious what their stake is in Europe in the future. But it isn't obvious to millions and millions of people who now are going to decide Britain's future in Europe. And unless we give them the opportunity to find that out for themselves, to understand in their own terms, in their own lives, British members of the European Union means for them, then we're in trouble. We're in big trouble, and that isn't happening at the moment.
Thank you, Roger. Can I ask Alex to briefly respond on how can you say Britain doesn't have any influence over Europe, which was Stuart's question, and then I'm really keen to take three more questions from the floor, so can we keep our responses up here a bit briefer? Thanks.
Okay, sure. Use that one. Stuart, you gave me a bit of a litany to respond to, so, you know, I won't try and go through all of them because it'll bore everyone to death. Business for Britain, red card on further bureaucracy. I mean, what's the point? We're losing fistfuls of money through the bureaucracy anyway. That isn't being clawed back. Ever closer union. The ever closer. Sorry, Stuart.
Is this the word? I mean, how are we building it? Is this the working time directive? You want to say the working
time? You know, there's actually a lot. And actually, what I find unfathomable is the concept that without Europe, we couldn't come up with our own workers' rights protections in our domestic parliament. The fact that we need to have someone else determining that and say, well, actually, if you weren't in the EU, there wouldn't be workers' rights.
UKIP is not in favour of workers' rights. It's a right-wing party.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah, well,
and actually, a ridiculously low blow, because I think you know, as well as I do, if you'd studied the various general election manifestos,
that, you know, I think you might think your political points thrown there, but you're actually showing you're not able to engage fully with the debate. No, in terms of our influence, let me tell you what our influence is. 8% stake in the European Parliament, and we all know that when the Commission pushes forward legislation that it wants to see happen, and the Parliament stands up to it, as they have done on major issues such as ACTA, as the German judges have recently done against TTIP legislation and the ICS, that the European Commission will turn around and say, sorry, no, we'll rewrite it, we'll change a word here and there, it will be pushed back through. The idea that there is a stake is ridiculous. The only potential victory that David Cameron has been able to publicly declare recently was not paying the EU contribution top-up fee of 2.1 billion last year. Well, he did end up paying it in two separate stages. I cannot think of a single example of where we've seen anything concrete or worthwhile come back to protect British interests. To protect, for instance, our steel industry against Chinese dumping.
We put last week saying TTIP was going to come to the NHS. Brussels has very clearly said
I don't think Brussels has. And actually, if you look at what I'm talking about, in terms of what's been going on with the German courts of law,
We want to ask more questions to the floor. Okay, we've got 15 minutes left. Gentleman at the back, and lady at the front, and the other gentleman on the far left. Thank you.
Thanks, my name is Martin. I'm here in my capacity as a Fabian member. I think I'm quite interested in testing the panel on Alexandra's hope that she wins the referendum. She says the parliament puts her in that position. So if I could take that stance, could the panel explain to me what the next 5 to 10 years holds for the UK, what it holds in respect of Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland? Would UKIP accept the immediate calls from Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland for membership of the EU, and therefore UKIP would become the voice of that part of the UK that voted for exit under her strategy?
Okay. Thanks, Martin.
In respect of the people of Wales, Scotland, Northern Ireland and those in England who wanted to remain? What that next 5 to 10 years holds for those people.
Okay, thank you. Next question, far left, and then Jenny at the front.
I'd like to make a few points first before I ask the question.
Briefly, if you don't mind, just so
okay,
we can get through.
Sure. First, the gentleman there, I didn't get the name because of the accent. You said there was a name and essence in Europe, but it's not the case. I'm only speaking out as a Welsh point of view.
Well, what's your name, sorry?
Oh, sorry, Paul Davis, member of Fagan and Cardiff North, CRP. Wales has always been a look towards Europe. It's very, very welcoming. The Six Nations is in Wales, you ask any Italian, French, or even the European, they all love coming to Cardiff. Wales is a very open country. We don't see other countries as a them and us. We always see ourselves as a part of Europe. Wayne says to get a change in Europe, there's going to be a long dialogue. I agree with that. The best people do that in Wales, because the Welsh always tend to see things from the other people's point of view. And that's why we're all engaged, and that's why we get change.
And your question is?
Sorry?
And what's your question?
Oh, okay. Just another quick one, I get another question. Alex, you said that you're the media expert, in Wales we're going to have a field day, because unfortunately there will be a few more assembly members of UKIP. Now you mentioned, and UKIP is very, very good at saying that the funding that will come to Wales will be the same if we're out of Europe.
Probably more, actually, is what we would say.
Now, you also mentioned democracy. Well, Wales has always been under the yoke of democracy. I mean, I remember that's a long time ago.
Come on, sorry, I really must press you to come up with your question.
Okay. Alexander, I'm still not convinced, on a Welsh point of view, what would be the main objectives of Wales if it came out of Europe. So that's my main question, is what do you actually see?
Okay, thanks. I got it. Jenny, final question.
I'm Jenny from Monmouth. You've all spoken about the democratic deficit of the European Union, which exists and it's a problem. But I think for the pro-EU argument, we need to defend its democratic record a bit more. Given that the European Parliament gains more powers in every treaty, that actually all the debates about that happen in the European Parliament are publicly available, which isn't the case for this Parliament. I just want to ask really like how you think we should be having this conversation with the public to really readdress what I think is a bit of misinformation there. Thank you.
Okay, great. So we'll take Martin's first, and I'll go to you first, Jeremy, if you don't mind. Martin, what would the UK look like if we weren't in the EU? And then we'll swiftly move along the table this way.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think what would thank you. I think what, in a sense, it's a leap into the dark on one level, isn't it? Because we don't know what the immediate reaction would be.
And it was especially with relevance to Wales and Scotland.
Absolutely, yeah. One thing seems to be reasonably clear, which is that this, in Scotland, the Scottish Nationalists have said, I'm not sure what Plaid Cymru's position is, that if there is a different result in Scotland and Wales from the rest of the UK, that would there'd be pressure for a referendum. Mm. And it seems to me pretty likely that the result would be much more strongly favourable to the SNP's cause as a consequence of that, of the UK voting to come out of Europe. So it seems to me that we are looking at the integrity of the UK as a unitary state coming into question pretty much immediately. There seems to be no question that in the longer term, the level of funding coming to Wales, so the level of economic opportunity, perhaps more positively, which Wales would be able to benefit from, would dramatically decrease. It would not change the global pressures on our economy at all. And some of the job losses which we've seen recently, in my view, would be exacerbated by being outside the European Union. But the other aspect to it is that we would, as a UK-wide, we would lose influence in the world. At the moment, we have a seat at the table in Europe, which is not just the largest trading bloc, but also a significant source of social protection for our people, and we would lose a voice and lose an opportunity of extending our values into Europe. And I think those are all very, very significant questions which should cause us pause.
Okay, thank you. And I'm actually going to ask each of you, I've just realised the time, I'm going to be in trouble from Alex if we overrun. So what we're going to do is, if you're okay with that, that was like your summing up. Sorry.
Very left.
You can have a tiny bit more time at the end if we have time, just for you if you haven't felt. But I just want to make sure that we address the three questions, which was, what would it be like if we weren't in the EU, especially for Wales, as we're in Wales? In terms of communication, how do we get the voice out there? And then Jenny's final question is again about communication. So I think we've got two questions about communication. Wales are good at this, and one question about what would it be like if we can all address all three of those as we move along.
Well, actually, I see all three subject matters deeply intertwined. I mean, Martin wanted to ask very, very seriously about post-Brexit, and I think that's very important because, of course, if we've got a government prepared to mortgage our future on a referendum in a couple of months, they must have done an impact assessment about what, if that referendum results in us leaving the EU, the impact that that will have. Why don't we know about that? Because it'll probably tell you all will be hunky-dory. That's why. What I find so interesting, going to what Paul was asking about the main objectives for Wales, interestingly, a hell of all the stuff that are EU competences at the moment would actually end up in Cardiff Bay. If you actually look at what are seen as European competences and Welsh Assembly competences, in the light of the very shadowy and incomprehensible draft Wales Bill, actually, by leaving the EU, what you'd end up with is everyone being far closer to proper grassroots democracy. And finally, Jenny, you're talking about the democratic deficits, which again ties in with that. All I would say is I think by and large, ignorance is bliss. The arguments that are being made by Europe don't seem to be arguments of a positive restructuring of how this is helping society, but they're arguments about scaremongering what will happen if we leave. Now, as far as I'm concerned, going back to the point about having an impact assessment, the doom and gloom picture that we're being painted, I mean, first of all,
picking up on something Jeremy said, when you look at trade in Wales, actually in 96, yes, 77% of Welsh trade was with the EU. Now, it's 43%. It's less than half. And actually, if you look at the way that Britain trades with Europe, trading of goods with the EU only accounts for 5 to 8% of our economic output. So I wouldn't be too worried about all these jobs suddenly disappearing overnight when you just need World Trade Organization rules. And so the arguments being made by the EU do tend to be scaremongering. Are they able to make constructive, positive arguments? I don't think so, no. Because what people are living with every day, what people are realizing every single day, is they're seeing jobs disappear. They're seeing factories like the Bosch factory in Miskin sent over to Turkey due to EU funding, with the help of EU state aid. What we are seeing increasingly is a Europe that isn't listening to us, that doesn't recognise our personal situation, our idiomatic needs. And it's acting in a way that we have to accept the consequences. Is there a constructive case to make? Well, do you know what? I don't think there is anymore. Which is why I am clearly by myself on this panel, but with currently 52% of people in Britain who just want the opportunity to make these decisions themselves.
Roger. Thank you. Britain outside the EU, well, another referendum in Scotland. Scotland would become independent. You'd get a land border back in, a policed land border, militarised possibly in Ireland, which probably will cost lives. Mm-hmm. And an emasculated England and Wales will go to the Americans to ask them to protect us. And I suspect the Americans would say no. So not great in terms of geopolitics. But I don't think we're going to decide on the basis of that. On the communication point, I think what we have to understand, and it is good that we've got Alexander here, and UKIP do speak for a lot of people who don't feel that others are speaking for them. And UKIP are also quite good at identifying problems. They're very bad, as we've heard today, at identifying solutions, because the solutions just make things worse right across the board. But there are some issues, there are some real things, real fears that people have. And I think the fear factor is strong. And we talked about Europhobia before. Actually, I think a lot of the time people are afraid of the unknown. They're afraid of perhaps themselves. They're afraid of the future. And I think the way to engage in this referendum campaign is not to have, you know, people shouting and telling people that people don't believe in statistics and they're not receptive to the arguments, I don't think, from either side. We need to try to give people a protected space where they can actually ask a stupid question, find out for themselves, and the most powerful thing that is going to change people's minds is not going to be what the In campaign say or what UKIP say, it's going to be what their neighbour says or what somebody else says, oh, you know, actually that's not quite true. People need to, because my granddaughter has just been on an Erasmus and that was very good. Or actually my son's got a lot of people working in his company that come from, you know, from Poland and they're very successful. These are the arguments. We need to make this real for people in terms of their own lives. And they can learn from each other. But none of that is happening at the moment. And that's what concerns me. And that's what needs to change. But all of the people in this room, all of you, can do that. You know, we're not preaching to the converted here. We're preaching to leaders. Each of you in your communities can go out and actually try to have those conversations in workplaces, at home, in schools, in different places. And just get people to have that, oh, yeah, I hadn't thought of that moment. Because I think that's our best protection from the kind of dystopia that we're going to face if Britain really does leave the EU.
Thank you, Roger. Wayne, would you like that one? Yeah.
Okay. Thanks so much. 3 points. Firstly, Martin's point about what if. I think that if the UK as a whole votes no, but within the UK, let's say Scotland and Wales vote yes and England votes no, then there will be a constitutional crisis. There's no doubt about that, I think there will be. Secondly, I think that if Britain votes no, there'll be a loss for Wales in terms of the structural funds, the common agricultural policy. And that's because we have a Conservative government. A Conservative government which is against Welsh interests, which wants to reduce public expenditure, and they will have a field day. The other point I'd make is, the big question is, our relationship to the single market. And nobody can tell what our relationship to the single market will be. We'll have to renegotiate a relationship with the EU, but we will not do so from a position of strength or advantage. We'll have to go cap in hand. Well,
It's true. I'm sorry the facts hurt. But I mean, we'll have to negotiate a special relationship with the European Union, and I think there's a possibility that many thousands and thousands of jobs in Wales will be put at risk. Second point I make is, let's have a debate with democratic deficit. Absolutely right. I personally would like to see the voting age reduced in this county to 16, but linked to that, I'd also like to see proper political and social education in schools. And I think knowledge about the European Union, objectively taught, is absolutely central to having a democratic society. The third point I'd make is, let's be clear, this debate is not about Britain versus Europe. This debate is about progressive internationalism or narrow British nationalism. Let's be clear also, the political lines are very, very clear. The people, by and large, 90%, who are opposing Britain's membership of the Union are UKIP, which is a right-wing party led by Neil Hamilton, Mark Reckless, Nigel Farage, all dissidents from the right wing of the Conservative Party.
Sorry,
I didn't interrupt you. All dissidents from the right wing of the Conservative Party and the right wing of the Conservative Party. They were people who will be arguing a narrow nationalist case, which is against Welsh interests and against Britain's working class interests as well. Those are the clear divisions, and I think that this country, Wales especially, needs to be full square behind a progressive internationalist case for our full participation in Europe.
Thank you very much to all our panellists. I'm sure if you want to continue the debate after this session, that can happen. That our panellists are here. Do come up and ask some questions. Thank you very much. Everybody, we've got a 15-minute break, which I didn't realise. So I thought we were moving straight on to the next session. But do you want to stretch your legs for 15 minutes or chat to our panellists?
Do you think we can get that message across?
It will be.
And the result in Wales depends on the Labour heartland and getting that message across.
Yeah, and they will respond to it.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, to be honest, it is just.